I'm going to I put together a number of interesting cases that are basically to illustrate some of the things that I see every day in my practice, and very common things that we see in the infertility world. And they present very interesting challenges from the psychosocial, the legal, and the religious point of view. So I think it'll be really interesting to hear everybody's point of view for all of these cases. So I'll just, while we're getting that going, I'll start off just by reading the first case since I can see it here. There we go.
I'll just take a minute to mention one thing about the continuing medical education credits. If there's any medical doctors in the room, I have this personal learning project tool sheet that you can use to submit your request for credits. This works for the specialist college. I'm not sure about the family doctors college, but anybody who wants this, please come up to me after the program. I'll give it to you. And if you have any questions about how to use it, I can explain it.
Okay, I think. There we go. Okay. Oh, that was the. I'll have to get through all the slides there. The next one. See that sperm again there? Sorry. There we go. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, great. That's perfect. Okay, so the first case that I'm presenting is a 41-year-old woman and 46-year-old man couple who are Orthodox, and they follow the Nida ritual. And they've been trying to conceive for 1 year. And basically they came to see me. They have... when I take a history, the woman has menstrual cycles every 24 days with 6 days of bleeding. And she usually goes to the mikvah on day 14 of her cycle, which turns out to be about 4 days post her ovulation. And basically, all the tests that we did on the female partner are normal. The semen analysis was deferred as per the rabbi's request. They requested that we do the tests on the female first. And so basically, at this point, the difficulty here is that the woman is ovulating at the time that she's, before she goes to the mikvah, so obviously she's not going to be able to get pregnant unless we change that situation. And this is a common type of situation that I see in my practice, and what I usually can do in a situation like this is I can actually extend the cycle by giving medications that will prolong the time till she begins her ovulation. And I say usually because sometimes that can be quite difficult, especially in women as they get older. So we're going to talk a little bit about what happens when we have difficulty doing that, and I'd like to hear the rabbis, especially his input on that. So this is something that we see commonly as a cause of infertility, and it's something that we can help a lot of couples. So I've just drawn a picture here of the menstrual cycle, and I'd like to maybe get the rabbi's input about how the Nida works in terms of the whole scenario and some of the religious issues in that regard.
Okay. First of all, what medication do you normally give? What, Clomid or something like that?
Yeah, I would use something like Clomid, or sometimes I can use a birth control pill prior to the cycle, and that will slow down the ovulation.
Right, this issue is obviously extremely challenging within the religious community and has been dealt with in a plethora of ways. While normally the whole notion behind the laws of Nida in most cases is actually to create a mini honeymoon on a regular basis so that there is the opportunity. I don't think I have the time here to go through all the laws of need down their philosophical ideals, although if someone wants me to do that, I can do that offline or at a different time. But the bottom line is that I've actually had conversations with Dr. Ruth about this, where she actually wanted me to write a book with her on this stuff. And my wife nixed that idea. She makes most of the decisions in our home. And basically, in our conversation, there is literature that has been written by sex therapists about the benefits of an imposed opportunity on a monthly basis for husband and wife to remove themselves from the sexual experience and then to reengage in a way that really celebrates on a regular basis these mini honeymoons. The halakha is pretty clear about the husband's responsibility the night in which the wife returns from the mikvah. And most of the time, mikvah and the opportunity to have a sexual relationship with one's spouse at the time of returning from the mikvah normally is timed at the time of ovulation. But as the doctor indicated, not everybody works on the same clock, and there are sometimes challenges. So there are some times in which medicine is used, like Clomid. However, the problem is that sometimes Clomid, again, I'm speaking out of turn, so I apologize. I'm not a doctor, but there have been times in which Clomid has actually created infertility. There are small percentage of times that I'm aware of that Clomid has created infertility. So you got to be careful exactly when using that. But there are several other ways of dealing with this issue. One way of dealing with the issue is evaluating exactly how many days the wife abstains from having relations before she goes to the mikvah. That is a pretty complicated protocol. It requires one to speak to their local Orthodox rabbi. There's a difference between whether you're in the Sephardic community or in the Ashkenazic community of how you deal with those issues. But clearly, when necessary, under the guidance of a competent religious leader, there can be truncating of a day or so, which can make all the difference in the world regarding this issue of what I would call halachic infertility, when Jewish law causes the challenge. Another issue, in addition to the Clomid issue, is using IUI. In other words, there is no prohibition whatsoever for a woman to be inseminated when she is in the status of nida. Since there is no sexual relationship at that point, there is no problem with her having being inseminated at the time in which she's in nida. Yes, there is a Gemara that speaks about the idea that a woman should not become pregnant when she's in nida. So that Gemara, if one is concerned about that Gemara, which not everybody is, but that Gemara can be obviated simply, and this is again a little bit above, I think, our conversation here tonight, but what would happen is the woman would go to the mikvah twice. She would go to the mikvah right before the IUI to dismiss what would be called the biblical challenge of Nida, to obviate that piece of Talmud, and then she would go to the mikvah again at the normal time that she's to go to resume having a physical relationship with her spouse. But the IUI, which is essentially inserting the sperm at the entrance of the fallopian tube, allows is the capacity without using any drugs for one to be able to get pregnant if there is that halakhic challenge, and even when truncating days and doing all the other halakhic calisthenics that can be done to deal with the issue. If it still doesn't work, then IUI can deal with the issue, especially within the parameters that I just articulated. Now, the reason why sperm analysis is sometimes deferred is because sperm analysis is a little bit more of a challenge from a Jewish legal perspective. So therefore, we first want to evaluate whether there is infertility challenges within the woman. But once we are sure that there are no infertility challenges within the woman, then we should proceed on checking the man for any challenges. The first way of checking would basically be using a PCT test, which again allows one to do a basic sperm analysis, not a full clean sperm analysis. But if the doctor feels that that is not enough, then the postgym would permit, the religious decisors would permit a man to express sperm in order simply for it to be checked to afford the opportunity of going through procreation. Exactly how that sperm is expressed is a discussion amongst the religious community. If someone wants me to focus on that in particular, I can. For our conversation, as I'm painting broad strokes here, doing the twinkle, twinkle, little star approach to this issue, that basically is a basic overview.
Can someone just explain what a PCT analysis is?
PCT is a post-coital test. Basically, what we do is examine the sperm at the opening to the cervix after intercourse to see if there are sperm there and whether they're moving and within the cervical mucus. So it's not as accurate as a semen analysis, but it is a way to say, yes, there are sperm there, yes, they are moving, yes, there is a potential for pregnancy. So in this particular case, that if we move on, basically they tried for 5 further months, no pregnancy occurred, and then a semen analysis was requested, and we've already discussed that would be allowed, I guess, after that period of time. What was found in that situation was that the count was 10 million per cc, and the normal sperm count is 20 million, and a low motility, or which was 25%. Normal motility would be 50%. So at that point in time, the doctor recommended artificial insemination, and as Rabbi Brandon was saying, this would be, I'm assuming, would be allowed at that point in time.
100%.
Absolutely. Now, the question came up, though, that some of the visits for monitoring for ovulation or insemination fall on the Sabbath. So the concern was, what happens in that situation?
That's a great question. Regarding doing some of the visits on the Sabbath, there's also other issues. For example, let's say you're in an IVF procedure, and an IVF procedure, one of the biggest challenges there is, I'm just adding to the question, the woman will take all different types of hormones in order to stimulate many follicles, not just one. So you harvest more than one egg, you harvest many. And therefore, the woman has a sonogram, and at one point it will be told to the eggs need to be harvested, or else the woman's life can be put into danger. Right? So what happens if all of a sudden that date is in Shabbat, that the eggs need to be harvested? Then you have an Issa D'Oraisa, a biblical prohibition of what's called dash, or what's called you're just removing from its source. It could be several of the 39 creative labors. These are some of the halachic issues. So, you know, it's when you're in Israel, so the doctors choreograph some of these issues so they don't happen on Shabbat. Shari Tzedek and other hospitals, Bikuchowim, which, by the way, the hospitals in Israel, this is one of the great things that Israel has. It's one of the only things that all Jews get along with, whether you are ultra-Orthodox or you basically, you know, eat pig every night. One thing that all Jews want is to have children. And so there's one thing, there's perhaps the only thing in the state of Israel that everyone has, there's a common denominator around, is the notion of infertility procedures. So Bikur Cholim Hospital, for example, which is right outside the more right-wing community, has a robust infertility clinic. Shari Tzedek, Hadassah, and others have robust infertility clinics. In some ways, they're more ahead of the United States on certain issues. PGD is covered by insurance. Infertility is covered by insurance. Certain PGDs are covered by insurance. And infertility issues are cheaper in Israel. The Ministry of Tourism could do a whole little thing. You know, come to Israel, have a child, and it'll cost you less money and see the country. So the question now becomes, what happens when you're outside of Israel and you have a lot more of the Shabbat issues, which really are not really as challenging as they in Israel as they are outside of Israel. So in cases that I've dealt with, many cases that I've dealt with in this issue, so a couple that wishes to actualize the dream of having children has decided to go through this process, you know, are considered in what we call halachic terms, achola she'ein bo sakana, people who are not in any danger, but they're struggling with a psychological need to have children, and therefore Jewish law has a certain license in those cases. There are certain laws on Shabbat that are I don't want to say ignored, but are muted in order to allow people to deal with those issues. So in cases like, for example, some of the tests needed to be done on Shabbat, so while I would not encourage someone to drive, someone who is fully observant of Shabbat, to drive on Shabbat to the hospital, there's no reason in the world that they could not be by the hospital before Shabbat, or stay over by hotel near the hospital before Shabbat and be able to walk to the hospital. Or if they needed to, for some reason, would say the hospital was not near any civilization in any way, shape, or form, or was impossible, to maybe arrange for a car service to take them. There are different things that can be done in order to accommodate, and if the test does not need to be done on Shabbat, which sometimes the test does not need to be done, the example I gave you, for example, of retrieving eggs, is follicles that have been stimulated, that definitely you can't postpone that for a long window of time because you could put the woman's life in danger. So we deal with the issues. We don't we do not allow the woman not to actualize the capacity to have children. This is not only for visits. This also has to do with, say, the doctor wants them to do some type of test, an ovulation test, which also could be viewed as a prohibition on Shabbos. Or the woman needs to take shots, which could be an isser of what's called chavala, a prohibition of wounding on Shabbat. All of those issues have been dealt with in a rigorous way within Jewish law, and there are ways around those in order to make sure that the celebration of Shabbat does not compromise the capacity for a couple to be able to have children.
Cliff, I'm just going to add one line in there, just to add that humanistic component, which is also that at age 41 for this woman, there's also, my guess is that she's been trying a year, which probably implies that she was married a little bit later as well. So, of course, there's an understanding that everyone has to appreciate that Dr. Liebrecht spoke about at the beginning, that as we get older, you're not as fertile as you were. And I know many people will say, oh, my mother had a child when she was 47, and very rare to have your first child. Not rare, but the older you get, the harder it is to have a first child at over 40. Not that it doesn't happen, because it certainly does. So I think we're also adding the component to her, which is that each month counts, that each month that her cycle doesn't work out on time or as she had hoped, that there starts feeling that little bit of panic that will add in because time becomes more of the essence with
Absolutely.
Each passing month.
Please, we want this to be very interactive, so any questions, please.
Good question.
That's going to put me out of business. Huh?
Well, let me answer it in a way that will not. Assuming that both the Jewish doctor and the non-Jewish doctor were equally qualified to be able to do the procedure, then and only then I think it would be better to use a non-Jewish doctor. Yes.
Go ahead.
Right. About the insertion of the embryo or the final product on Shabbat.
I think unless the doctor says that it's either now or never, which I'm not sure that you would need that, why couldn't it be done on Saturday night or Friday, unless due to certain reasons, then I think that it's best not to do it on Shabbat. But if there was circumstances beyond control, based on the conditions within the within the uterus itself, which the doctor felt it needed to be during that specific 24-hour period of time, so then again, halachically, I think it would be permitted, but with the understanding that it would be better to use a non-Jewish doctor if, again, assuming that they both had equal competence, because that most probably would be a prohibition of seeding of Zorea. So, but again, for reasons that I don't think is appropriate to go into at 20-9, I think it would be permitted, and I think that we would try to make sure that that did not happen. But if there was no choice, we would not compromise the couple's ability to have a child, especially after the hard and tumultuous path that happens, before you get to the point in which you return the fertilized egg to the womb.
Thank you. One other thing that often comes up in terms of this type of case is the production of sperm and whether or not some rabbis say that it must be done through an act of them coming together and using a condom with a pinhole. So
right.
Can you comment on that as well?
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of different approaches. I think that is the easiest one. I think, again, the first rule here is that the doctor needs to make sure that the capacity to be able to do what needs to be done is being done in the best way. Because the issue is that you don't want to waste sperm. Sperm is a gift from God. We don't believe in wasting sperm. So while we try to make sure that the sperm is expressed in the most natural way, which would be to use a condom, obviously without spermicide, with a pinhole on the side so it would not compromise the sperm, but it would be the most normal way. In other words, the potential for the sperm to enter into one's spouse. So that would be the best way from a halachic perspective. Well, let's say, for example, that's not possible. Let's say that's not possible for a host of different reasons. I'll give you one example. Let's say, and again, I had most of my training happened in Israel. So let's say somebody lives in Gush Etzion, right outside of Jerusalem, and they're having fertility challenges. And if they do it this way, and then they bring the sperm and the condom, the distance is too far to the hospital, especially during the Intifada, when sometimes, this is not a joke, especially during the Intifada, when the roads between Jerusalem and the Gush Etzion could be closed for hours. And all of a sudden, the sperm is no longer functional and cannot be used by the doctor. So what do you do then? These were the questions that were being asked amongst, the religious community. What happens if you live in a kibbutz somewhere? So actually, there were certain hotels that worked out a deal with the hospitals, hotels in Jerusalem, that allowed the couple to have the privacy of a hotel room and not be compromised by the distance that could happen due to the intifada or other things of that nature. It was done in a very modest way. But if for reasons that still cannot be done, so then if the sperm needs to be expressed in a different way, then it would still be permitted. But there are different levels of permissibility. We try for the best way, and the best way is the way the doctor articulated earlier, and that is to create the most normal course of action. But if that can't be done, other ways are still permitted.
Great. I was going to also talk about the fact that if this couple were trying for a period of time and they weren't able to be successful, that this is often a time when they're having difficulty coping, they're thinking about going to more advanced techniques, and that they would see a counselor for support. So maybe Jan can comment about people that have been trying fertility treatments and they're having difficulty because they're not successful, and how you discuss the next steps with these patients.
Well, again, as I spoke at earlier, one of my jobs is to help people navigate the system. And one of the first things, of course, is that they have a comfort level with the professional help that they're seeking. So one of the major things that I try to do is make sure that people are feeling comfortable with the physicians, Christian or Jewish, that they are seeing. And then again, it's also being able to open their eyes to options that are available to them, helping to familiarize them with reproductive technological options that do exist. Because often it's very easy to get on a treadmill or you get into a doctor's situation and you start moving quickly ahead on what is out there, what's going on, what medically is happening. And I like to stop and have people kind of sit and think about what are they looking for, what are they hoping is going to be accomplished. And by that I mean what kinds of technological options may work for them. So could they potentially look at what I often say, I think of the gold standard as being his sperm, her egg, her body. That's the gold standard. That's what we're hoping for. But sometimes we don't always get gold standards. Sometimes we get silver standards. Sometimes we do necessitate the use of a donor gamete, which is something you said you were going to talk about a little, Sharon, right? About a donor gamete. So not that it's a first choice, but it may be that it will require the use of a donor egg or a donor sperm or potentially the use of a surrogate or a gestational carrier to help you carry the egg. Or it may be looking at another option and seeing whether adoption may be something that could work for your situation as well. And I think often by being able to find an environment where it's safe and comfortable, that you can just talk through the issues and talk through the sadness and the disappointment that is often associated with things not working out exactly the way you hoped. But it's perhaps opening your eyes to some really incredible options. May not be exactly what you hoped for, but nevertheless, it may still turn out to be something quite incredible.
So a patient like that we were talking about where they failed intrauterine insemination.
They never fail, excuse me, Dr. Ebrecht. Okay. The technology fails them sometimes. They never fail.
All right. Exactly. Where the technology failed them. Would then be recommended to go through a procedure called in vitro fertilization with intracytoplasmic sperm injection. So that would usually be the next step in a case that we've described. In vitro fertilization, people hear the term, but many people have never seen or understand what it is. But basically what we do is we stimulate the ovaries. And if you look up here, I don't know if everybody can see this, but basically what we do is we stick a needle, and that thing moving up and down is actually a needle coming from the vagina going into a follicle, which is an egg sac, and sucking out the fluid from that egg sac. And that's how we actually extract the eggs from the woman in order to use them in the laboratory to fertilize the eggs. So this is the technique that we use called egg retrieval or ovum retrieval. And when we get the eggs, they look something like this. So if we talk about eggs, this is what human eggs look like under the microscope. And when we try to fertilize them normally in vitro fertilization, we basically place the sperm with the eggs to try to fertilize them outside the body. And often this might be done in a case where there was blocked tubes or something to bypass the tubes. But in the case of this particular case that we talked about, that wouldn't work because the sperm count is very, very low and the odds of it working would be very low. And with about 10 years ago, an incredible new technique happened in our technology in fertility called intracytoplasmic sperm injection. What this involves is actually taking a single sperm and injecting it right into the egg. So I'm going to show you what that looks like. If you can see right here on the top of the screen, that single sperm is in that needle, which is now injected into the egg. And this is magnified about 2,000 times. And you can see that particular sperm is now sitting inside the egg, and it will eventually stop moving and will then combine with the nucleus of the egg and form an embryo. And so it's an incredible technique. This is what an embryo looks like after it's divided once into a 2-cell, 4-cell, and then an 8-cell embryo. Embryos are usually put back into the woman either at this 8-cell stage and sometimes in the next stage, which is about 5 days later, called the blastocyst. So, and this is what happens, the blastocyst hatches and then attaches to the woman's uterus in order to create a pregnancy. So one of the other things that comes up in vitro fertilization is the idea of rabbinical oversight for the laboratory procedure. So we often have this request from Orthodox Jewish couples that come to see us, and I'd like to know some of the comments that you have about that as well.
So, again, I can't speak for the challenges within Canada, but however, even in the United States, where there are some pretty strict rules and regulations regarding the use of labs, there have been situations, even in the past 6 weeks or so, where the news announces that there have been certain challenges in labs where, in order to increase the stats, for example, successful stats, they'll give a little booster to the sperm of the husband using the sperm of a of another person, either the doctor or somebody else of that nature. Now, 99.9% of the times, if there are challenges, they're not God forbid on purpose. They're accidents that happen. But there have been times in the news, and I'm just citing an example that happened a few weeks ago. But that this was not an accident. This actually was choreographed. And based on this issue, it has always been the preferred feeling amongst the rabbinic community that there needs to be some additional oversight. Not that the doctors are not trusted to do their job, but an independent person that is there to check to make sure that when the IVF happens or the ICSI IVF happens, which was just explained, that the ICSI IVF and the IVF happens in a way from the moment that there is the sperm retrieval and that there is some type of hashkacha, some type of oversight to ensure that the sperm, which defines paternity, or the egg, which according to some defines maternity, are not in any ways mixed. And hospitals in Israel, for example, Bikur Cholim Hospital, other hospitals have full-time Hashkacha, and hospitals in New York, as well as in Florida, and infertility clinics also have Hashkacha, some type of supervision on demand. This allows a couple that is concerned about these issues, which is really the concern that is mentioned by most of the religious decisors, the rabbinic community, the Minchas Yitzchak, who was one of the great poskim of the past generation, great religious decisors of the past generation, was concerned about this. He was the head of the Eidah Haredes community, but really knew the law and the science with great clarity. There was always this concern about hashkacha, about there being some type of oversight. So I would you know, insist or strongly encourage that any time a religious couple is involved with this procedure, that they try to make sure that there is some additional hashkacha, there is some additional oversight, and that the COR, is that the pastor's here, or the OU or the Chavke, not only be worried about the kashrut of food, but also the kashrut of these issues, which will make the situation much easier for the future. And I think from a psychological perspective, because see, there's another piece here that is important to recognize. In 20 years from now, these children, or 10 years from now, when these children become a marriageable age, then you're going to start really hitting the issues. Right now, the issue is, you know, do they go into day schools, this and this, and that's no big deal. Now, all of a sudden, they're going to start dating. And what's going to happen is that as they start dating, there's going to be a whole new set of questions than the ones that are asked within the Shidduch community. I don't know how that works in Toronto, but in parts of the United States, it doesn't border on absurd. It's way past absurd, way past absurd. We're way, way past absurd. And there's going to be a whole new set of questions that are going to be asked. And these are the questions that are going to be asked when IVF was used, or when donor sperm was used, or donor eggs were used, or surrogate mothers were used. We don't want to create, God forbid, OU kosher babies only, or Chafke kosher babies only. You know, I'm saying it in a joking way, but I'm brutally serious, unfortunately. And so to answer the doctor's question, I think it's very important that there is hashgacha, because it will just help deal with some of the psychological challenges that the couple doesn't even realize are going to hit them, but are only going to hit them in 20 years from now. And this eases some of those issues.
Thank you. How much, when would you like this? Because we have...
About 20 minutes.
About 20 minutes, okay.
So Rabbi Tendler has always told me, Rabbi Tendler says, Kenny, you're too worried about this issue. There's a fear of government thing. Why should you have to worry about that? Except in the case of Chol Hasadim, Chol Va'akum, you haven't found anyone using pig's milk. And in the case of this issue, I mean, who am I to disagree with Rabbi Tendler? What he forgot, I'll never know. But there are thousands of posts. There are tens of poskim that disagree with Rabbi Tendler. So I'm just, you know, standing on their shoulders. But the bottom line is that doesn't work, because the United States has pretty rigorous rules and regulations. And the bottom line is that just read the papers. It happens. Again, I can't speak for Canada, but it's happened in the United States, because it is a business. It's a robust business. Stats are all they count. And what happens is, if your stats aren't what you want them to be, so there's ways of getting around it. So.
The second half of the question was that, I guess, in Canada, has it happened? And how easy is it to actually get supervision, let's say, in your own
We definitely would allow, or the husband, to go in as well. We've done that for artificial insemination and also for IVF. So it's something that we would definitely allow. They would have to obviously be garbed in the proper way and not be interfere with other people's situations, but it would be something we could allow. It could either be the husband or a rabbi.
See, in America, it could never be the husband, because there are certain rights of privacy issues regarding the sperm of others in there. So the person would actually have to be an employee of the lab in order for it to be able to accommodate. Again, I'm totally out of... If I thought I was out of my field when it comes to medicine... I'm totally out of my field when it comes to legal issues, but you know, in the United States, these issues are big issues because of what was said so well, that United States, sometimes people sue at the drop of a hat. They don't even wait till the hat drops; they sue. So the bottom line is, there are all these laws of secrecy, of privacy, of all these issues. So, for example, Dr. Richard Grazi, who has a practice in Brooklyn, has someone who does the hashgacha. But he is an employee, or she, it can be he or she, is an employee of the Institute, which removes all those other challenges. In Boca, we trained a whole bunch of women in how to do this, to watch, and they became de facto employees of the company for that time. They were paid by the company in order to deal with the OSHA and other issues, legal rules and rights of privacy.
Let me add... Can I answer that question? If a couple are going through IVF or IUI, they don't do a DNA test when the baby is born. So has it happened? Probably more often than we know. If there's a surrogacy, then we have to do a DNA test in order to get parentage into the right hands, so to speak. And that, you know, the case will reveal itself. Has it happened? There have been no documented cases. There have been no lawsuits that have been reported.
Actually, there is one case in London, Ontario, where they realized right after the insemination was done that there was a mistake made. The woman didn't get pregnant, so it wasn't an issue, but that was the one case that I'm aware of in Canada.
There have been international cases where a black child is born to a white couple, and so, you know, it becomes quite evident without DNA tests that there was a mix-up.
That's my nightmare, so... Anyway, we don't have a lot of time, but I'll try and move through some other cases that are very interesting in this area, and we can't possibly cover every area. One other area that comes up, especially in Ashkenazi Jewish people, is the idea of genetic testing, because, of course, there's Tay-Sachs, and there are now other diseases that we have tests for. So if we take this case further, I'm taking the example where they both are carriers of the disease called Canavan's disease, which now people are more aware of. You know, there's an association in Toronto now, where a charity organization for this particular disease. And we talked about pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. So I just want to show you a picture of what that looks like. This is a picture of an embryo that is at the 8-cell stage, and you can see that on the right side of the screen there, there's a called a pipette that's sucking out one of the cells from that embryo. And what's incredible about this technique that's now come up into being in the last just few years, really, is you can take that individual cell and test it genetically to see if it contains the baby would have that particular embryo would have be a carrier or actually affected by that disease, and then choose embryos among a group of embryos in order to implant back into the woman. And so that's what PGD is. And if you have a couple with Canavan's disease, I'm just showing what happens. You can have a child that's normal, a child that's a carrier, which would have both genes from a normal and the Canavan's, and a child that is affected that has both genes from the parent. And the odds of that is about 1 in 4. So that's an interesting new technology that we have. The other area that comes up with in vitro fertilization that's also interesting is the idea of when we place more than one embryo inside, because the odds of pregnancy when we place one embryo inside, especially in women who are older, is much lower. And, of course, in our country where there are significant costs involved as well in the United States, people are wanting to increase their odds. So the more embryos that we place inside, the more chance the woman's going to get pregnant, but the more chance she's going to have more than one baby growing in her uterus. So one of the problems that comes up, and I took the example here where the woman put 4 embryos in, which is not an unusual number of embryos to put in women over 40, because their odds of pregnancy are actually much lower, and the odds of having a multiple birth, even with that number of embryos, is actually quite low. But let's take the example, because whenever we place more than 1 or 2 embryos inside the uterus, we always have to discuss this possibility of being a higher multiple birth, like a triplet or quadruplet pregnancy. And, of course, that's an increased risk to the mother by carrying that kind of a pregnancy, and it's a significant increased risk to the children who, because of the risk of prematurity, and children that are premature have more risk of cerebral palsy and learning difficulties and lung problems and so on. So we've got risk to both parties in this situation. And so one of the options that's available nowadays is called selective reduction. In other words, reducing the pregnancy from a quadruplet pregnancy, which is really not likely to be a viable pregnancy, down to something more reasonable like a singleton or twin. So this issue comes up, and I'd like to get comments about that particular issue from a religious point of view and also maybe from a psychological point of view as well.
So first of all, let's start with the genetic testing. This issue of genetic testing, there's actually an organization, I don't know if it plays a role in Canada or not, called Dor Yesharim, which does testing. There are pluses and minuses to Dor Yesharim. The pluses are that they do genetic testing. The minuses are that they don't always reveal to you what exactly are your genetic challenges. So what happens is, let's say you get tested and you get a number, your number 62. And then the guy gets tested, let's say the woman gets tested, she's number 62, the guy gets tested, he's number 115. And all of a sudden, number 62 and number 115 are going out on a date, they've gone out on a whole bunch, and now it becomes serious. They call Dor Yesharim, and they say, number 62 and number 115. And the Dor Yesharim will tell them whether together they have genetic challenges or not. And if they tell you you have genetic challenges, the question is whether they really reveal to you what those challenges are. Then there's another testing that gives you, which, and Dor Yesharim pays for the testing. So there's essentially no cost to the young man or young woman to do the testing itself. And then there's other testing that's done in which you're given a full disclosure of what you've been tested for, and therefore you have that information in front of you. I'm much more an advocate for full disclosure than I am for the closet way of doing it. But bottom line is, I believe that every single young man and young woman, before they go through, before they start getting seriously involved, should go through genetic testing. So much so that Yeshiva University actually sponsored a project for its students to go through genetic testing. And there was a letter signed by every Rashi Yeshiva and myself encouraging every single member of Stern College and Yeshiva College to go through genetic testing. Now, I don't know if every single student at Yeshiva University went through genetic testing, but the opportunity was afforded to them and will be afforded to them on a yearly basis for basically no cost in order to obviate some of the challenges that can happen, KSACs and other things that could happen when there could be certain genetic disorders. That's the easy question to answer. However, the issue of fetal or selective reduction is a much more challenging question to answer. Fetal reduction, even though Judaism, interesting enough, does not consider the fetus to be a full human being until the fetus is born or until the majority of the fetus is born, so much so that Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, who recently passed away, permitted in the case of a TASAC situation in which the couple was extremely concerned about the challenges of having a TASAC baby that they know would pass away in a short period of time, he permitted there to be for there to be abortion in that case, which is a pretty, pretty major thing for a rabbinic leader who was in charge of the rabbinic leadership of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. Sorry?
Up to the seventh month.
Rav Moshe Feinstein and others were... What? No.
What was the question?
You knew that this baby, they did an amniocentesis, they knew the baby had TASACs. Rav Moshe Feinstein and others were against that. The point being that the fetus is not considered a human life, but we don't discard the fetus as if it's, you know, nothing. It has a quasi, as Maimonides puts it, a quasi status of a human life. Kiro Dave, for those who know the terminology of Maimonides on this issue. But in the situation in which, by returning so many embryos, that you put the mother's life at risk, clearly in that case, fetal reduction is permitted. Because the mother's life is of paramount importance. The fetuses, we violate the Sabbath to save the fetuses, but the mother's life is of importance. So if the doctor felt that these fetuses would create a situation of danger for the mother, then they could be reduced. If the doctor felt that some of the fetuses will survive better than others, because based on the doctor's feelings regarding the growth of them, then one could probably also reduce. The question becomes the following, which is dealt with also. What happens if the doctor, what happens if you can reduce, and you can reduce either male or female? You can make that decision. And let's say you have boys at home. So in order to fulfill the mitzvah of having both boys and girls, you want to reduce the boys in utero and just keep the females. Or vice versa. Can you do that? So actually, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu permits even fetal reduction when permitted using gender. However, the vast majority of poskim, religious societies, say this fetal selective reduction, correct me again if I'm wrong, doctor, is a very, very challenging procedure. I mean, you insert some type of, I guess, poison or something within the sacs of each embryo, and what happens is you can have sometimes spontaneous reduction at the same time. They can lose more than one fetus. So I think the normative approach is that if fetal reduction is permitted due to certain challenges, what you do is you tell the doctor to reduce the easiest one to reduce based on where they're orchestrated, where they're lined up, and to do that and not worry boy, girl. Again, we don't wear the glasses of God. Just make sure you have healthy children and a healthy couple, and would make that the prominent importance.
Thank you. Any questions about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it
could you just repeat the question?
The question is, when you take the cell out from that eight cell, the picture I showed, embryo, does that put the embryo at risk? Yeah, there is a risk to the embryo by doing that procedure. Hence, there has overall in the world literature been a lower success rate when that procedure is done in IVF. And what was the second question?
I think when there are genetic issues, I think it's 100% permitted for the following reasons. At that point in time, the fertilized egg is not yet considered any status of a human being. Under 40 days, the fertilized egg is considered maya ba'alma, sack of water. So, for example, there is a law in which the firstborn of a woman goes through a process of pidyon haben, redemption of the firstborn. The woman has a miscarriage, let's say, in the fourth month. So the law is that even though she'll have if she has a child afterwards, that child does not go through a redemption process. What happens if the woman has a miscarriage, and the miscarriage happened, and you can tell that the miscarriage happened, was less than 40 days old? So then the next child would go through a redemptive process because it is not yet considered any status. So therefore, when you have a situation where at the blastocyst stage or so of development, or earlier, right? A little bit earlier than the blastocyst stage, you do PGD. So at that point in time, it's only a few days old. There's nothing wrong with that. It's much better than doing an amniocentesis otherwise or other things of that nature, which can create fetal distress. And depending on the age of the pregnant woman, the amniocentesis can cause also some type of a miscarriage. The stats are predicated on the age, but as a woman gets older and therefore amniocentesis are often more demanded, the capacity to have miscarriage becomes greater and greater. So a PGD is a much better way of going, especially if it's to obviate genetic issues. No, issues of PASACs, issues of maybe they're worried about other issues, blindness or other issues of that nature, if that can be told through PGD. Any issue of genetics, I think PGD is 100% permitted for. Most posts can say PGD is permitted even for sex selection. I actually just wrote an article that just came out in Tradition last week on the issue of PGD. I'm sure there are people here who have Tradition. Someone actually just told me they read the article. So you're more than welcome. If you're not, you can email me. I'll send you a copy of it. I'm sure Rabbi Kalman gets Tradition, yes. And he can give you that article. Okay, don't worry about it. You're not missing much, but it would answer your problem and your question.
Sherry, our laws for sex selection are different, aren't they?
We are not permitted under the Assisted Human Reproduction Act to do PGD for the purposes of sex selection. It has to be linked to a medical condition. So, for example, hemophilia, that's the easy one. Right. But simply for the purposes of balancing family or choosing the sex of your child, it's a prohibited act, liable to criminal conviction.
So in Israel and in America, where that's not the case, which, by the way, I would love that to be the law in America, but that's not the law in America. You can do it. You can do PGD for anything. And in Israel, it's also you can do PGD for anything. So the religious decisors are they're all over the map on this issue. See, what happens when you have this cutting-edge science, especially in the beginning of the process, different rabbis weigh in on the issues, and they know the issues, they know the science. And at this point in time, PGD, which is a relatively new procedure, you have people like Rav Neuwirth, who wrote Shmir Hashabbos Kilchasa, that says it's forbidden to do it whatsoever. You have people who extrapolate from Rav Yashiv that it's only permitted in certain cases like genetics. And then you have others that say it's permitted even for sex selection. In the article that I wrote for Tradition, I was asked particularly to comment on those issues. I articulate the different approaches of the different rabbinic personalities on this issue. And again, if you go on a website called yutorah.org, you will find, if you look at the column for Rosh Yeshiva and you click on it, you'll see a list of my classes there. And in there will be a list of letters, letters that have just been, they're not published yet, they're still in handwritten form, from different rabbis on the issue of PGD, whether it's permitted for sex selection or not. And you can, you know, download all that information.
I apologize to the people who didn't get to ask a question on this case, but I just, the time is so short, and our speakers put together five cases. Perhaps we'll move on to the second case.
Okay.
And please, afterwards, all the panelists will be here. You can come ask us your questions.
Actually, the last part of this case is fascinating, and I think everyone could comment on this. This is the issue of what happens when you have frozen embryos that are left over and you have to decide what to do with them. I think that's a very interesting issue because it'll touch on a lot of the other cases. The first option that patients have is to have them destroyed. And in some religions, they actually, we've been asked to place the embryos in the woman's vagina where they would basically suffer a natural death. So that's been a sort of ritual that we've been asked to do in that situation. The second option that patients have when they have extra embryos left over, that they, when they're not planning to have further children, and that could be because of reasons for maternal health or other reasons, they're not wanting to have more children, basically they could donate them to research. And I guess the third option is they could actually donate those embryos to another couple, and in Canada that would usually be anonymously, that they would donate to another couple as a sort of embryo adoption. And then the last one would be an example where a woman had a medical condition where she couldn't carry the baby, and because she was now developed some disease such as diabetes, and she then ask a surrogate to carry those embryos for her. So I think that gets into some of a lot of issues that are interesting from a point of view of psychological, legal, religious. Jan, what are your comments about that situation where couples now have embryos left over and they have to think about what to do with them?
I think one thing that I wanted to make clear, even when you were talking before about multifetal reduction, is that every decision that a couple makes comes with great angst. You know, none of these decisions, none of them, once we enter the world of infertility treatment, are made lightly. And I need that really understood, because very often in the popular media, we get the impression that decisions are just being, just a decision, just thrown out. I need you to understand that the couples that I see that are dealing with any of these issues agonize over a decision. So you're left with frozen embryos. It may sound very easy to just say, well, I'll just do any of the options that Dr. Liebrach has just outlined. But these are not easy decisions to make, especially if you've already given birth and sitting before you are children that have come from these embryos. It makes it very different when there's a human face placed on it. So often you really have to go back and really think about what is going to be the impact on the health of the couple, not just physical, but the psychological, the mental health, financial health. How is that all going to fit in for them as well? It has to be looked at from all the different parameters. And again, there's no easy answer. And this is where you do have to examine both looking and very clearly. This is the kind of the honor of sitting on such a panel, is because sitting here tonight, it's been such an incredible honor to listen to the different perspectives placed over issues that I may think in one direction, and yet you listen tonight and you see that it opens up into hearing the medical, hearing the halachic view, hearing the legal view, but ultimately the decision has to rest comfortably between the two members of the couple. And again, we go back to what I said earlier. We want to work very hard at being on the same page. Not on the same line. That's not always a fair expectation. But you have to work towards getting on that same page and appreciating that you are coming often from slightly different places, but that you're looking at that common goal of working for, well, shalom bayit, peace in your home, huh?
Sherry, what was your...
You know, we're back to twinkle, twinkle, little star territory here.
That's a legal word.
Sue and you shall be sued. when it comes to embryo donation, Jan is absolutely right. People agonize. And if people haven't agonized, then I start to worry, because there are tremendous issues to be thought of here. And not to contradict my friend Dr. Liebrach, but most of the embryo donation, and it's not adoption because these are not babies, right? We're donating embryos, we're not adopting them. Most of the situations I have seen are known. They are not anonymous. The people meet because there are so many different factors to discuss. If the first couple have children and they're donating extra embryos, will they want the children born to the recipient couple, will they want them to be able to meet the genetic parents? Will they want them to be able to meet their siblings? Will they want a flow of information, which I think is crucial in terms of medical information? Because when you choose to accept a donation, you will get a snapshot of the medical information of those donors. Now, our medical information changes on a daily basis. If there is no opportunity to update that information, then you are working in the dark. And how do you successfully plan for the health of your child and the child's medical treatment if you really don't know what has happened since? There are always contracts between the donors and the recipients where they deal with these issues and future contact. And the most thoughtful of my clients have also added stipulations about when will they tell their children, because they don't want the donors to tell their children years and years before the recipients tell their children, because they want to be able to control the flow of information, especially in an open and known situation. The other point I want to make when it comes to embryos is, although we have not in our Canadian courts decided how to treat embryos, it is clear they are not life. In the United States, they also don't deal with it, but the courts have said because they have the potential of becoming life, we must treat them with the highest respect, which I think that, you know, is a very nice way of approaching it. But embryos can be bequested, and so I advise every couple that's going through IVF and has frozen embryos to consider what would happen in, you know, God forbid somebody dies, what would they like the other partner to be able to do with those embryos? And the only way to make sure that those wishes are carried out is to put it in your will. So that's an important point. And I'll stop twinkling the star there.
Abby, what do you advise people on that?
First of all, I haven't really gotten that question too often, so I can't really say I've advised that many. I've actually once or twice gotten calls saying, we have extra embryos, thank God, a few children. We'd like to know if we can donate them to somebody who would like to also have a family. Clearly, I think that's permitted. I think that there are issues once you define, you know, paternity is defined by the sperm donor, maternity. There is an argument amongst the rabbinic community. The vast majority either say it's the genetic donor. The larger group actually says it's the host mother who's the mother. And when you bifurcate the issues, that what should define a parent is the nurturing, not just the genetic gift. But what is interesting is that, and that, you know, that brings a whole bunch of issues, because if you celebrate your Jewishness through the identity of the mother, what happens if the donor or the surrogate isn't Jewish, does the child need to go through conversion? I mean, there's a host of different issues there. And obviously, in the case of a donated embryo, you have to deal with some of those issues. So clearly that's permitted, and also I believe it would be permitted for it to be donated for research. And I think that this is a fundamental difference between the Jewish tradition and the tradition within the Catholic community. And that is that the Jewish tradition really endorses the notion of stem cell research in a full, robust way, because it leads the opportunity to be able to deal with so many different diseases on a cellular level and to be involved in that imitatio Dei, that playing the role of working with God. And so any opportunity that there is to create a new line to be able to be involved in stem cell research is something that the Jewish community, I think, would endorse, which is, again, contrary to the Catholic community's position on issues. There are many issues that we work together with the Catholic community. On this issue, we do not. There's a real serious divide between the two. Again, so I think either one of those two options would be preferred.
One last question that I want to ask that's come up, I think, getting towards the end of this, but this is an issue that I see often with egg donation, and that's the question of whether the donor is allowed, it should be Jewish or non-Jewish. What would be your, I know there's differing opinions
right,
on this.
There are differences of opinions on it. I think, and since only we're already 5 minutes over, so I won't give, again, the twinkliest of star approaches. I think that it's best that the egg donor be Jewish and single for a whole bunch of different reasons, which I'm not sure I can go into right now. Jewish and single mean that either they've been married and they're now divorced or they haven't been married at all. The only issue you have to worry about is the fact that, let's say this woman donates an egg, the couple has a family, there's a nice little boy, 20 years later the boy is dating a girl. How do we make sure that the boy is dating the girl, assuming that there isn't that communication that was articulated, isn't dating a sister? Sheva Yisa Basachosa is the Talmudic term. And so we've worked out ways that the egg, even if the egg donor is anonymous, minimally give the birth date. So when the guy is dating, he can at least see if the woman that he's dating, the mother, has the same birth date as the egg donor, then we have a little bit of a challenge. But assuming that they don't have the exact same birth date and from the exact same city, then you would obviate that issue. So I think the best would be egg donor, single woman.
A lot of times I've had rabbis say that the donor must be not Jewish.
Right.
That's another point.
There's different approaches. This is the approach of Rav Mordechai Eliyahu in Israel. There are others who say differently. Non-Jewish, in order to obviate the issue that I just mentioned, because then you don't have to worry about the dating issue. However, then you deal with another issue, and that is whether the child needs to go through a conversion. So you have to decide which issue you really want to deal with. And so therefore there are rabbis who choose door number one and there are rabbis who choose door number two.
What about sperm donor? Same thing?
Sperm donor should be a non-Jew for sure because of the definition of paternity. Rav Moshe Feinstein has two tshuvot about that. Rav Moshe Feinstein encouraged if a couple cannot have a child and they want to use a sperm donor, they should use a non-Jewish sperm donor. Rav Moshe Feinstein's house was firebombed because of that radical tshuva. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in a book, in a periodical called Noam, the first volume, Noam Volume 1, also has like a 20-page article where he agrees with Rav Moshe Feinstein on that issue. One can, look at Rav Moshe Feinstein's response or Noam's response to see those. Well, it doesn't make a difference what he says. He has two tshuvot Igrot Moshe where he says halacha lemaisa. One is he says it and then somebody asks a question on him and he says, I know all your issues, I still say it. So whatever Moshe says in Yevamos, which has to do with the two children who are converted in utero, that's the Gemara that he's talking about there. Rav Moshe, in his response literature, which was always halacha lemaisa, that's why he got firebombed, says that you should do it, and you should use non-Jewish sperm, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach concurred with that approach in an article that he wrote.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Just before we thank the speakers, just want to remind everybody, if you're interested in signing up for any of the Torah in Motion programs online, to speak to Shalom Eisenstadt over there, who can explain that to you. Please make certain to fill out the evaluation forms. It's very important to us in order for us to put together programs in the future. If you're interested in CME credits, come get a blue sheet from me. And I would like to thank all of our speakers for doing such an excellent job.
And I'd like to thank Barry again for providing the funding for this. And all the organizers as well.